From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. And next hour, Sir Charles Schulz III joins us. Updated Mars data and riveting new energy source information. Happy birthday, by the way, to Art Bell, founder of Coast to Coast AM. And he emailed me tonight. He's got some great news, wanted to share it with you. The U.S. Immigration and Citizenship Form Services has approved his wife Erin's permanent resident status. Art thanks all of you for your assistance in writing letters to the president. And that's good news. As he said, what an ordeal. A Montana town where asbestos contamination has been blamed now for more than 200 deaths will get an additional $6 million in cleanup and medical assistance from the Obama administration under a public health emergency. The declaration is the first issued by the agency, which has grappled with the toxic legacy of a mine outside Libby, Montana, since 1999. The town was heavily contaminated with asbestos-laced dust that federal prosecutors said resulted in more than 200 deaths and 1,000 illnesses. Not only did the dust from the mine spread all over Libby and the neighboring town of Troy, Montana, for decades, but tailings from the facility also were used as fill for driveways, gardens, and playgrounds. The World Health Organization is sending an expert to Libya to look into a reported outbreak of bubonic plague not far from the Egyptian border. Libyan officials say at least one person has already died. Several more have been infected in a town there. Cases of this disease, which was known as the Black Death in medieval Europe, are reported quite frequently in that area. Bubonic plague can be treated with antibiotics if diagnosed early. Humans who contract the plague through flea bites normally develop a bubonic form, in other words, a form that enters via the skin. The anti-cancer properties of carrots are more potent if the vegetable is not cut up before cooking. Take heed, according to research. Scientists found that boiled before-cut carrots contain 25% more of an anti-cancer compound found in carrots than those chopped up first. Autopsies have revealed fractures in the legs, hips, and arms of Air France disaster victims, injuries that, coupled with the large pieces of wreckage pulled from the Atlantic, strongly suggest that the plane broke up in the air. With more than 400 bits of debris recovered from the ocean's surface, the top French investigator expressed optimism about discovering what brought down Flight 447, but he also called the conditions far from land in very deep waters one of the worst situations ever known in an accident investigation. Typically, they say, if you find intact bodies and multiple fractures, arm, leg, hip fractures, it's a good indicator of a mid-flight breakup, and that's what they're finding. There was a lack of clothing on these bodies as well, which also, they say, results in an air breakup. President Barack Obama has proposed sweeping new rules of the road for the nation's financial system, casting the changes as a critically important response to the economic crisis and the greatest regulatory transformation since the Great Depression. President Obama blamed the financial crisis on a culture of irresponsibility that he said had taken root from Wall Street to Washington to Main Street. And he said regulations crafted to deal with the Depression of the 1930s had been overwhelmed by the speed, scope, and sophistication of a 21st century global economy. The Obama plan, though, would give new powers to the Federal Reserve to oversee the entire financial system and would also create a new consumer protection agency to guard against credit and other abuses that played a big role in the current crisis. Marching in dramatic silence, many with tape over their mouths, hundreds of thousands of Iranians kept alive public support for opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi, even as the government stepped up efforts to stop daily protests calling for a new presidential election. The large crowds gathered in central Tehran for a fifth day now of protests. The demonstrators are demanding that officials throw out the results of the balloting Friday that kept hardline incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in power. And the Iranian-American community is half a world away from the turmoil in Iran, but they are tuning in, logging on, even stepping out on demonstrations to show solidarity with relatives and friends. Americans with Iranian roots showed their interest in the election by voting at more than three dozen polling places then, from Washington to Los Angeles. Iranian Americans check newspapers, cable news outlets, radio shows. They're also turning to YouTube and social networking sites such as Facebook and Twitter to get information in and on what is going on there. Hussein Hejazi continues to look at the Iranian situation for us. Hussein, I guess the internet is helping now, isn't it?
Absolutely. Good evening,
hey.
Mr. Nouri. Yes, the internet, as you mentioned, Twitter and the Facebook, is the main source of transferring all the information. The pictures, which are very disturbing, and the images are so gruesome that I cannot explain it to you. And as you mentioned again, Iranian protest for the fifth straight day is continuing. And tomorrow, Mr. Mousavi has called for demonstration and rally around 3:30 in the afternoon. Tehran's time means 4 o'clock our morning time.
When we talked a couple days ago, we talked about a major soccer event on Wednesday.
Yes.
What happened there?
In soccer team, that was another show of solidarity in this soccer game. And on the first part of the game, the players came in with the wristband, with the green wristband, as a show
for Mousavi, right?
Show for Mousavi. And in the second halftime, when they came in, all of them, those bands were gone. And it was said that they were forced to remove them, except the captain of the team that didn't obey the rule. And he came, he was the only one that who came in with the band on his wrist.
Hussein, how long is this going to continue where the protests go on? I'm not sure the government is going to permit this to last much longer. I'm afraid of some massive bloodshed here.
I'm hoping that that doesn't happen, but, you know, the crowd is so large and it's so huge that it's out of control of the government, and especially the nightly protest of the people, that they go to the rooftops and they shout Allahu Akbar, means God is great, all night long. Is so loud and so, mind-boggling that they don't know what to do. Actually, we don't know which direction we are heading for, and the danger of some of these militias and the plainclothes people joining the protester is something that is concerning the government authorities.
Yeah, and I know our administration, too, Hussein, is very concerned now about what's going on, these latest developments in Iran. And, of course, there are developments all over this planet right now that we're concerned about. Russia, China, North Korea. In a moment, a global analysis with Jeff Nyquist. We're going to talk with Jeff about all these situations. NASA, by the way, planning now to launch an unmanned rocket to the moon on Thursday. It's the first such mission in a decade. Space Agency announced plans for the launch after deciding to postpone the space shuttle mission because of a hydrogen gas leak, as Richard C. Hoagland reported on this program last night. The robotic moon probes will hunt for hidden ice. The mission will cost $583 million. The sun is in the pits of a century-class solar minimum. We know that. Sunspots have been puzzlingly scarce for more than 2 years. Now, for the first time, solar physicists might understand why. At an American Astronomical Society news conference in Boulder, Colorado, the researchers announced that a jet stream deep inside the sun is migrating slower than usual through the star's interior, giving rise to the current lack of sunspots. The nation's newest texting champion has a message for parents all across the land, although they might not want to hear it. This is what Kate Moore, a 15-year-old, says. Let your kid text during dinner. Let your kid text during school. it pays off. Well, it did for her. She won the LG U.S. National Texting Championship. She's from Des Moines, Iowa. 14,000 texts per month reaped her reward. They give her $50,000 for this. This was her very first cell phone. Can you imagine that? 14,000 text messages per month? That's a lot. In a moment, Jeff Nyquist joins us. His latest book, Origins of the Fourth World War. We're going to talk about global things on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. You're going to enjoy this hour. Jeff Nyquist is an expert on Russian and communist military and foreign policy. Currently an independent journalist, writer based in Eureka, California. He has previously worked for WorldNet Daily, Newsmax.com. He also writes for FinancialSense.com as well and is the author of the book Origins of the Fourth World War. Here he is on Coast to Coast this hour, Jeff Nyquist. Jeff, welcome back to Coast.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, about 10 years.
That is a long time. I want your overview, Jeff, on just everything that's going on this planet right now. Put it together for us.
Well, it's always important to look at the big players, and the big players are Russia, China, and the United States. And, of course, we had the Cold War, which supposedly ended back when, but never say never. Nothing really ends quite. And the nuclear weapons, many of them, a surprisingly number of the nuclear weapons that existed during the Cold War, are still in play. And one of the things that's happened, perhaps the biggest thing, because nuclear weapons are the most destructive, damaging, you know, they can ruin your whole day sort of thing, the U.S. nuclear arsenal has been decaying in recent years through inattention.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
The Bush administration had wanted this new nuclear warhead program. When the Democrats got into Congress about the time that they wanted to implement the program, the Democrats balked. The program didn't go through in 2007 and 2008. And now that Obama has been elected, he absolutely has told Defense Secretary Gates, no, we're not going to do this. Instead, he wants to go to the Russians and negotiate really big, truly final nuclear arms reductions. And so this is, you know, very important to the administration. There's this philosophy that if we lead by example, by getting rid of nuclear weapons, we will have a much safer world. Unfortunately, the truth is that certain numbers of nuclear weapons are what's prevented a third world war and has kept us safe.
I think so, too. What are we going to do, Jeff, about North Korea? I mean, the administration is saying we're not going to tolerate them having nuclear weapons. Well, they've got the nuclear weapons. They've got them now. What are we going to do about it?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I think that we have to hold China and Russia responsible because I don't believe that North Korea would have the weapons if it wasn't for assistance from Russia and China. And the same can be said of Iran. We know that Iran's nuclear project owes a great deal to the Russians. And we have to realize these smaller countries don't really have the wherewithal on their own to create the tools they need to build a nuclear arsenal without help. And really, North Korea is clearly a sort of a satellite, a joint project of Russia and China, although it has its own crazy, unique form of government, which is extremely isolated from the rest of the world. I mean, they don't have the internet there. They don't have much contact with the outside world. And they have been just immersed in a kind of mind-numbing propaganda that the Americans are evil, and they're in this tremendous battle with us. And it's, you know, if you talk to experts on North Korea, they'll tell you that the North Korean leaders are differently rational. They do not share the same rational universe that you and I do.
And how do they generate their economy, Jeff? I just don't know what they do.
Well, it's a subsistence economy that's highly militarized. All the youth of the country's in the military. They've had massive starvation. In the last decade and a half, more than a million North Koreans have died easily of starvation. Conditions are appalling. But because they claim to be in this sort of war, you know, with the United States, South Korea, and Japan, they can justify it to their people. And being a small country, they receive most of their conventional weapons from China. And, you know, I suspect through my sources, I suspect that a lot of their nuclear capabilities come from Russia.
I think so, too. Now, your work, Origins of the Fourth World War, What happened to the Third World War? Did I miss something?
Well, in my book, I explain it's sort of a play on words in that people think that World War III is the end of the world. But really, there's been a major misunderstanding about how nuclear weapons are used in a real war. And, I've heard people, even politicians and supposed experts say, oh, well, a couple hundred nuclear weapons and the whole world is destroyed. Well, that's not true at all. And there have been major studies, but people don't seem to read them because they're too dry and dull. Nuclear winter theory was discounted a long time. That on the beach fallout kills everybody was discredited a long time. And besides, the weapons now are very clean. They've been clean for a long time. That is to say that they're not made to create purposely fallout that kills everybody. They're made for destroying immediate military targets of the enemy. It was even back when Jimmy Carter was president that we abandoned mutually assured destruction. The strategy has been to fight a nuclear war to destroy the enemy's nuclear and strategic weapons in the war. So the nuclear weapons are largely aimed at each other.
Albert Einstein once said, I know not of what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. What do you think of that, Jeff?
That's always possible that we could have, we don't just have nuclear weapons now. But people have to understand, war is really about strategy. It's not really about the weapons. The weapons are part of the strategy. And that there's, as Sun Tzu said, all warfare is based on deception. Hold out baits, entice your enemy, feign disorder and destroy him. And, we won a nuclear war in 1945. We dropped two nuclear weapons on Japan and they surrendered. See, that was a nuclear war. See, the ideal thing is for one side to use the weapons on the other and the other not to be able to fire back.
Exactly. Now they can fire back. And that's a dangerous case, isn't it?
Well, when both sides are on a hair trigger, and we've come close to accidental nuclear war. In fact, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, we've come closer to accidental nuclear war than during the whole Cold War.
What do you think of this Iranian situation, Jeff?
It's fascinating, and I'm kind of hopeful because I've talked to Iranian experts, and, the Iranians are a great people. And maybe George Bush, let's hope, there was something right about what he did in Iraq because they've established a kind of a Shiite democracy in Iraq, and maybe this is part of the influence of people in Iran who have close contact with the people in Iraq, that this democratic idea, they finally realized, hey, we can demand to have a say in our politics. And it may be that the Iranian people want nuclear weapons for themselves, but wouldn't we feel a lot safer if it was the Iranian people who had the final say-so in decision-making in their government? I think we'd all feel a tremendous sense of relief because the average person everywhere wants peace.
I'm looking in my crystal ball, Jeff, and I think one day, I don't know when, but one day some lunatic will get a hold of some kind of nuclear weaponry and do something stupid in some Western city. It's just a matter of time, isn't it?
Well, the real danger is, people don't realize these facts. The real danger, I think, is that a major power will use nuclear terrorism as a stalking horse. I once asked a Russian defector in 1998, a high-level Russian military defector. I said, I've read the Russian literature, and they talk about winning a nuclear war. I said, how do you get away with winning a nuclear war without getting flattened by a counterstrike? And this defector said to me, if you ever hear that an American city is attacked by nuclear weapons by Arab terrorists, don't believe it. And I said, why not? He said, because it'll be my people. It'll be Spetsnaz. And it turns out, lo and behold,
interesting.
There's a book written in the 1980s by a GRU defector from Soviet military intelligence. He writes under the name Viktor Suvorov. The book's called Spetsnaz. And in the book, he describes how Spetsnaz will start World War III by using terrorism, and the terrorist campaign will begin, and the terrorists will be seem to have no connection with Russia, no connection at all. Everyone will think these other terrorists are attacking the U.S. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, it's Russia has hired them as mercenaries controlled by intermediaries.
Might that have happened during 9/11?
Yes. In fact, it's called Gray Terror, and you remember Alexander Litvinenko was the Russian former KGB officer,
right,
poisoned with polonium-210 in London. You know,
we watched him wither away.
Yes. And, you know, I couldn't believe the mainstream press missed the whole story. The whole story was that he had named Ayman al-Zawahiri as a longtime KGB agent.
That's a good point. I want to talk a little bit more about that, Jeff, when we come back. And also we'll take phone calls with Jeff Nyquist on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Sir Charles Schulz III joins us, A Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars. We'll also talk about new and emerging industries and technologies. When we come right back, we'll take your phone calls with Jeff Nyquist on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll take your calls in just a moment. Jeff, let's talk again about that connection of al-Zawahiri and the Russians. It was real. He trained with them, didn't he?
Yes. In 1996, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two man in al-Qaeda, went to Russia. In fact, the reason that Alexander Litvinenko knew about it is that he was in charge of maintaining the secrecy and security of al-Zawahiri's mission to Russia. This was revealed by former KGB officer and writer Konstantin Preobrazhensky, who confirmed Litvinenko's testimony about Ayman al-Zawahiri being a longtime KGB agent. Litvinenko also said that other prominent members of al-Qaeda were KGB agents, but he did not name them. He showed a Polish journalist friend of mine a picture of a terrorist training camp in Russia, in Dagestan, actually, where Zawahiri was trained.
What's your take on the fact that bin Laden seems to disappear? We get these audio tapes from him every once in a while. I think Zawahiri's clearly the one who's running the show now.
It does look that way. The actual videotapes of al-Qaeda leadership, when they're made, it's Ayman al-Zawahiri on the tape. And it's very disturbing that this small, sort of spontaneous terrorist movement that did so much damage on 9/11 is ostensibly led and organized by a man who has been named by former KGB officers as a longtime KGB agent, especially when also out of Czechoslovakia, you know, Mohamed Atta, there has been, you heard about the story that Mohamed Atta traveled to the Czech Republic shortly, several months before 9/11.
Right, right.
Well, Vladimir Huchin, who was a political prisoner under the Czech government, he'd been a Czech security officer who was trying to blow the whistle on things that were happening there, told two people who told me this that he said that Mohamed Atta had been trained in a terrorist training camp in communist Czechoslovakia in the late 80s, before the collapse of communism in Czechoslovakia. Now, I've been unable to confirm this, but if it's true, it would mean that now we know that the Russians, they were training terrorists. They trained Yasser Arafat, for example. Carlos the Jackal was trained in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was involved in training terrorists, from Latin America and Africa and the Middle East for decades. This would not be a strange thing, and that they still maintain agents and a level of control, that terrorism has always been a weapon of the Soviet Union and now the Russian Federation, and we see that the KGB is in control of the Russian government.
And, of course, Putin, a former KGB officer, probably never left.
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
Let's go to some calls. Lewisburg, North Carolina, first-time caller. Hi, Ron, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. First-time caller, wonderful program, a very informative, extremely informative program. I've been listening to you, I guess, this past year, and I love your show. I agree 100% with your guest, Jeff. I'm 57 years old. I'm a Vietnam vet. My both sons both fought in Iraq 15 months. I have one quick statement. As any nation that has a leader that believes by disarming or dropping your shields will send a message to its enemies to do the same, has a fool for a leader.
Any reaction to that, Jeff?
Well, I would ask President Obama to really reconsider and think again about his policy. I have a friend who's worked in the nuclear area for many years, and he told me a few months back that Pakistan has a greater nuclear weapons manufacturing capacity right now than the United States. We need to write our congressman and say, hey, we want to have our nuclear deterrent intact. We don't want to let it atrophy. We don't want a treaty with the Russians because the Russians have basically broken most of the arms control agreements that they have signed with us. And, you know, I say, why not be safe? These nuclear weapons are a cheaper form of defense than our Navy or our Air Force or our Army. Let's keep these weapons and live in peace.
Are you saying upgrade them or make more?
We need to upgrade the weapons we have, and we need to maintain the level of weapons above the level of 2,000 weapons. We should not go below 2,000 strategic nuclear weapons on readiness. One of the things the president wants to do is de-alert our weapons, that is, take them off of missiles that are poised to launch on warning. I don't think that's a good idea because it is possible these weapons are so fast that if another side strikes, it's possible they could destroy your capacity to mount the weapons in missiles and delivery systems and make it impossible to launch a counterstrike.
Isn't it baffling how AQ Khan from Pakistan just seems to be living still the life of Riley?
Well, I suppose nuclear scientists are very special people. And I don't know quite what to make out of the nuclear weapon capacity of Pakistan. They've got about 80 nuclear weapons. They don't supposedly have missiles that can reach the United States, of course. They've got India breathing down their throats. You know, I think that we want to win the Muslim world over to us. We want to show that we mean everybody well. We're not a big bad bully. We just want to live in peace and trade peacefully with everyone. The real problem is these countries that have thousands of nuclear weapons that can launch tremendous first strikes against the United States. China's building up this capacity. They don't have it now, but Russia definitely has it, and Russia has a fourth-generation nuclear warhead, something we don't have at all, and they have road mobile intercontinental ballistic missiles, a class of weapon we don't have at all.
Well, we should have those then. Serge in New York, New York. Hello, Serge. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. It's a pleasure to talk to you. A very good program. I would like to ask Jeff, what does he think about the military exercise that Russians supposedly have all the time? The last huge one they had in November when they launched for testing 17 intercontinental ballistic missiles. And also they announced that they will have another huge one by the end of the summer in Belarus. And another one close to Georgia. What is Jeff's opinion about all this?
Well, it is very interesting and it's very alarming. This all-arms nuclear war exercise they conducted some months back was astonishing. It was an accomplishment because they were hitting targets all over the place, precisely making multiple rocket launches. I mean, it was an achievement that even the U.S. hasn't done anything quite like this, proving that their ability to wage missile war is even at a higher level than it was under the Soviet Union. These military exercises by Georgia and by, you know, in Belarus near Ukraine are obvious demonstrations that they consider Ukraine and Georgia to be satellites that they want back in the Union. And I think there is a movement to put the Soviet Union back. And, of course, the infiltration, they've got their agents throughout these countries. And these demonstrations help to weaken the will to resist by people who are resisting by political means.
You know, part of the problem, too, Jeff, no one trusts the other side. I mean, everybody distrusts each other. And I guess with that mentality, they'll always be doing what they do.
Yeah, I think distrust is a good thing because that keeps everyone honest. After all, if we distrust each other in a healthy way, instead of, you know, we don't want to be paranoid, then we all are sort of vigilant against each other and it keeps us all on the straight and narrow. I think that's a good thing.
Let's go to Indianapolis, Indiana. Tim, it's your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi, George. I'm a longtime fan of the show.
Sure.
And even sent you some bumper music. But anyway,
excellent.
I did have a question for Mr. Nyquist.
Yeah.
He mentioned that it might be possible that the Russians would use it as a front, terrorism, hire some mercenaries and nuke a city in the United States. What about if the American intelligence found out about that, kept it a secret, and hired their own mercenaries and did a counterstrike on, say, St. Petersburg?
Well, I hope that the United States wouldn't do that. Doing an evil thing to another country is, even if they're trying to do it to you in this case, isn't good, because we're a different kind of country than that. We don't blow up cities with innocent people unless, you know, we're at war and they've attacked us first. And I still then have qualms about it.
Well, I got, you know, the jury's out though on Iraq. I mean, we have decimated that country. A lot of innocent people, Jeffrey, have died.
Yeah.
And they never attacked us. I mean, and they even Dick Cheney admits that that Hussein had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I'm referring to nuclear attacks on other people.
Right.
I mean,
all
the United States, I mean, the United States cavalry attacked Indian villages back in the 19th century. Every country in war commits atrocities. I think that I don't know what the U.S. government did exactly in Iraq. I know they bragged about having precision bombs that weren't hitting civilians. I think the real tragedy in Iraq is the civil disorder that killed tens of thousands of people, perhaps hundreds of thousands, in the wake of our occupation when we didn't have sufficient troops to secure the country.
Yeah.
That was, I think, more people died in the civil violence and disorder that followed our occupation than died in the actual bombings. And that was the real tragedy in Iraq.
And the depleted uranium one day is going to take its toll there, too, I'm afraid.
I don't know much about the science on that, but it does seem to be that there's some effect from that, that when kids come and play in that dust, it gets into their bodies.
You know what's interesting, Jeff? Why does one side trust each other? For example, you know, we'll never be at war again with the Brits, our brothers and sisters to the north in Canada, Australia. I mean, we're friends with all of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and we'd never, ever consider that they would attack. Yet, why this battle and distrust with the Russians, the Chinese, in all these other? Why can't we react to them like we do these other nations?
Because they're a different civilization, and because they possess completely alien ideas about politics and the government of their society. They are a different economic and political and military unit than we are. I mean, we have been integrated with the British since World War II. If not in World War I, we were also working with them. There's a kind of cultural and economic interrelationship that is very profound. I mean, when the War of 1812 ended here, we signed the longest lasting arms control agreement between Great Britain and Canada and the United States on the Great Lakes that has ever come about, and it's one of the few really successful ones. But you'll notice that a lot of the agreements in which we tried to limit Japanese or German arms before World War II failed. A lot of the Cold War agreements were, you know, basically broken before the ink was dry on the paper. It is because, particularly with Asiatic countries, with China and Russia, they have long-standing political tradition of lying and cheating, stealing and murdering, on a scale that Western countries, though they also do similar things in certain circumstances, it's not commensurate at all. The mass killing, lying, suppression, and bad behavior in those countries way outweighs anything in American or British history.
Let's go to the home of our announcer, Ross Mitchell, Reno, Nevada. Jeff, you're on with Jeff. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, good evening, George, and to your guest. I just wanted to ask your guest a question and to make a statement. Did your guest say that George Bush established a democracy in Iraq and therefore is going to influence Iran in some way? Because if he thinks that, I mean, I've been flying back into that part of the world since the 1970s. And if you think that having a soldier there is going to change a culture that's been living like that for the last 3,000-4,000 years, he's dreaming.
Yeah, I don't. I've been a major skeptic in my columns. I've been a major skeptic of democracy in Iraq, and I was very critical of the president's second inaugural address in which he proclaimed that he was going to spread democracy. I don't think that's practical. What I said was, with this ferment in Iran, that perhaps some of the attempt to bring democracy to Iraq, and there is, technically speaking, a democratic political system there. They have had elections and votes. They are a Shiite nation. Perhaps some of the ideas from there, being that both nations are Shiite, have had a cross-fertilization that has infected the Iranian Republic. So, you know, I'm just being hopeful in saying that. I am not a utopian, and I do not believe that democracy, whatever it is the answer for all people all the time. And I definitely disagree with President Bush's attempt to spread it to countries that are culturally not adapted to it, to our form of government.
You know what I find interesting too, Jeff? As we try to push democracy throughout some of these areas, we leave Saudi Arabia and Kuwait alone under kingdoms, you know, where this group of family members are pillaging the wealth from most, and they are. And yet that is off bounds right now. Why is that?
Well, it's pretty simple, because if we attempted to bring democracy to those countries, radicals would take power who would definitely, you know, strangle us with their oil or send terrorists out to attack us. I mean, that's the fear anyway. I don't know if they really would, but it's definitely a consideration.
But you see the message we send to the world when we attempt to move a democracy into one and not the other, because the other one is pro-Western.
Well, it's even worse than that. I mean, in fact, by pushing democracy in Iraq, we are destabilizing these other Middle Eastern countries, which, by the way, the entire Western world depends on for oil. You talk about an economic catastrophe. If there were a revolution in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, you know, we would be reduced to penury here in the United States and in Western Europe and Japan, because if oil prices went to, you know, $10, $15, $20, gasoline prices went to $10, $15, $20 a gallon here, you know, that would bring us to a halt in this country.
Absolutely, absolutely. I just think we need to be more above board with what our actions are. You know, come out and say, well, you know, democracy will work for this country, but it won't work in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and here's why we're not doing it there, because they're on our side.
Yeah.
I
think that that John Adams, or John Quincy Adams' statement on this was the best. He said, "We wish all countries well. We hope they find freedom, but we shouldn't be going out looking for monsters to destroy and spreading, you know, democracy. That's the wrong idea. We don't have the resources to do that, and we don't really have the moral, right to do that."
Let's see if we can get one more call out of Kentucky, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Wade. It's you.
Yeah. This is me. How you doing, George?
Good, Wade.
Thanks for taking my call.
Good.
Well, Jeff, I told you I'd make it through, hopefully.
Wow, Wade, I'm impressed.
Yep, I got skills. I was just going to call and, ask you a question and let you and George know. I was just before the show, I was reading a press report from AP quoting one of the main Japanese newspapers, that one of the ICBMs that North Korea is preparing to test is being intentionally positioned to come in around the Hawaiian Island area between July 4th and July the 8th. And so the United States and South Korea hasn't confirmed this, but this is just breaking tonight. And I thought I would ask Jeff just to lay out the scenarios of what if in the near future there is a conflict that erupts in Korea.
All right, Jeff, and we've got about 40 seconds. Go ahead.
A conflict in Korea would be a devastating disaster, not only for the U.S., but for Korea especially. Millions and millions of people would die, and probably hundreds of thousands would die in Japan if these weapons were used on the Japanese. And they could even, from what it looked like, hit the United States, because these are awfully large missiles that they're beginning to deploy.
Indeed, indeed. Website, what is it, Jeff?
It's jrnyquist.com and also strategiccrisis.com.
Very good. Thanks so much, Jeff, for being on the program this hour. When we come right back, Sir Charles Schulz joins us. We'll talk about Mars, and we'll talk about some incredible work in new energy technology.